happy new year.
Could be worse. He could be alone like that poor guy.
The most important part of this film happened on New Year's Eve. Does that make it a holiday movie? We're still up all night, and this episode, we watched Can't Buy Me Love.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to USA Up All Night with me, Aranda.
Hi, I'm Gilbert Gottfried, the comedian in the cupboard for USA Up All Night.
In this movie, you'll see two of your favorite stars. Now, if you drink enough beer, you'll start seeing more of your favorite stars.
Stay with me on USA Up All Night.
Welcome to the first Still Up All Night episode of 2021. You've found the podcast that celebrates the films of USA's Up All Night series. I'm Travis Yates, joined by my friend from the high school clique that would have started the AV Club, Rob Cady. Rob, happy 2021.
Happy New Year.
And it's a long time coming. I'm glad that 2020 is in the rearview mirror and we are moving on to hopefully better things.
It's the longest, slowest year ever, yet somehow I'm still in awe that the year is over.
Absolutely. And this episode, we've got what I call a themed film in honor of the holidays. It's 1987's Can't Buy Me Love. I say it's a holiday film. Rob says it isn't. So let's do this thing like they did in 2020 and argue about it and then walk away with neither one of us changing our minds. How about that? This is something that we've been talking about for a month now, and I'm glad that it's finally here so I can change your mind. Rob, I want to talk about why Can't Buy Me Love is a holiday movie, and then you can lay out whatever argument you want for why it's not.
All right.
Okay, so the movie's narrative takes place over one school year, but it builds to two poignant scenes. The second is, of course, the climax of the film, Ronald Miller's monologue in the end where he stands up for the jock and threatens to break his arm with a bat. But the second scene, and the one that I'd actually call the first climax of the film, is the New Year's Eve party. And I say this because I feel like the film almost has two protagonists, which is rarely done in film. Character types can be broken down into several specific categories. Your protagonist is often confused with being the good guy, but that's not always the case. It's just the main character of the film whose story is being told that doesn't necessarily have to be a good guy. Patrick Bateman in American Psycho is an example of a psychopathic killer who is the main character of the film, the protagonist. And then after the protagonist, you have major and minor characters that can serve a multitude of purposes, but typically they're there to help advance the plot or develop other characters more fully. And then, of course, you have an antagonist or plural antagonists who pose some sort of a barrier in the way of the protagonist accomplishing his or her goal. So Amanda Peterson's character, Cindy Mancini, evolves so much that I feel almost like she's a second protagonist in the film. And she and Ronald kind of almost end up each other's antagonist. So why is this important? You're probably wondering why I'm straying way away from the argument. Well, it's relevant, Rob, because I'd say that the New Year's Eve scene where Cindy confronts and defeats her antagonist, Ronald Miller, that's kind of the climactic scene for her. She reclaims her place as queen of the school, but she's changed and evolved as a person, and we see that in the way she spends more time at home with her mom and responds to her friends. She starts sticking up for Ronald, things of that nature. So that's my first point of why this scene that's so central to the narrative and to our characters, and it occurs on New Year's Eve over the holidays. So that's my first argument for why this should be considered a holiday movie. Any rebuttal to that?
I will agree with the majority of your points there, that she is like transitions as the movie progresses into, our antagonist or co-antagonist, and has this arc as long as, you know, Ronnie does. But I guess the pivotal response I have is, so take the holiday component out of the scene, and does the scene change in any way, shape, or form?
It does.
And I say no.
I say it does because it was the plot device that got not the whole school, but all of the popular kids together, which was the whole point of this film, of the desire to be popular and to be in this crowd. And without the New Year's party, he's not in this crowd.
But that could be any high school party whatsoever.
But it wasn't.
You know, you need no reason to have high school kids in a party scene.
But they chose New Year's Eve.
Well, because we're on a journey through the school year. You know, and their initial rental agreement is what, 4 weeks?
Yes, 1 month.
And then, yeah, and then as that ends, obviously he's now one of the cool kids. So you have to follow his journey throughout the school year as, you know, he ascends into the cool kids and then comes crashing down to the lowest of the low.
So my rebuttal to your rebuttal is that you could then use that argument with any holiday film and say, well, if you just take the holiday out of it, a family can get together for any reason. So let's not call it a holiday film. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. He could be trying to get home for any number of reasons. So if you take the holiday out, it's not a holiday film. But you can't take the holiday out. It's there. And so that's why.
But I think it has to play a key role in the plot itself. Like, okay. Christmas Vacation, you know, the whole movie changes if it's not Christmas.
Okay.
You know, you lose all the decorating scenes. You lose the tree scene. You know, you could have the turkey scene if you switched it to Thanksgiving, but you know it has a different effect because you're at a Christmas dinner. You know, and I would say you could make a case that Planes, Trains, and Automobiles really isn't a holiday movie either. It, to me, it doesn't play enough. It's just the as you said, the sort of the premise that gets the ball rolling, that if removed, the movie remains largely unchanged. Yep. The same reason why I say Die Hard is definitively not a Christmas movie.
Oh, you've just opened a can of worms now. Jeez. Yeah, the holiday in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is definitely the MacGuffin. So that's it's the carrot dangling that we don't ever need to see. Okay, so point counterpoint on that. All right, my next point is in terms of film structure. So films have three acts, and act one is the exposition where character and setting are introduced. And then once we have an inciting event, and in this case, it's the wine being spilled on Cindy's suede outfit and then her deal with Ronald, we get to act two, which is the rising action. And this is the majority of any film. And act two ends with a climax where the protagonist finally faces off with the antagonist and either wins or is defeated. Obviously, the protagonist typically wins in Hollywood because they go for the feel-good endings. So act three, then, is the resolution. It usually wraps everything up in a nice bow for the audience. It reveals how characters were changed by the result of the climax and where their characters are heading in the future. So there's something that almost every film has in their narrative, and that's a midpoint. And the midpoint of a film typically occurs in the middle of the rising action, and it's done to take the film in another direction. It's a device used to kind of freshen up the narrative in the middle of a film, so it's less predictable. Can't Buy Me Love is an hour and 30 minutes, but the New Year's Eve scene that serves as a midpoint for the narrative comes at 1 hour and 10 minutes with just 20 minutes left in the film. So this is a pre-climax climax. That's a new film term I just invented, Rob, and I'm sticking to my guns on this one. If a film's climax takes place during the holidays, it's a holiday movie. And since this scene is a pre-climax climax, it's clear evidence of a holiday movie.
Well, now if you have to invent a term to explain something, I think you're on terribly thin ice.
Okay, listen, here's a second piece, a third piece, really, of non-substantial evidence for you. So the other day, my wife and I were watching a fun little indie Christmas movie with Paul Rudd and Paul Giamatti called All is Bright. Have you seen this?
Oh, I've not even heard of it.
Okay, no. It's from 2013. It's fantastic, a dark comedy. But the movie starts with Giamatti's character paroled from prison, and no one's there to pick him up, so he's walking along this highway all by himself to get home. And my wife says, oh, this reminds me of Can't Buy Me Love when he's walking home alone on New Year's Eve. Now, Rob, you've met my wife. She's not a film connoisseur by any means, okay?
I married one of those, too.
She is lacking in general film knowledge. So the fact that she immediately went to this holiday scene in Can't Buy Me Love shows that the lasting impact from the film on the everyday viewer is the infamous New Year's Eve scene and its aftermath.
No, I completely disagree with that. The lasting effect has got to be the monologue at the end.
Okay, so though the film is the length of a school year narratively, I feel like the true build is to the holidays. When Ronald reaches his height of popularity, we see the school decorated with lights and garland. This is when Cindy tries to reconcile with Ronald, and he pushes back, telling her almost like a pre-monologue here. He tells her she saw him as a dork for 17 years, and now she wants to ride the Ronnie Miller Express, and that a ticket with another girl won't cost him $1,000. I feel like that's like the lost monologue of this film. And then that is followed by the New Year's Eve climactic party, where Bobby returns from Iowa and confronts Cindy. Ronald is exposed as a fraud, and he's left walking home alone on New Year's Eve. All the while, Auld Lang Syne is playing. Mm-hmm. His old friends are driving by. It's such a powerful scene. You say that's not a lasting impact.
Well, I think it is a lasting impact, but not the lasting impact from the movie. And I do concede that scene occurring on that holiday makes it significantly more impactful. So in that case, that holiday does matter.
I feel you coming around. Now you've just given a reason why that scene needed to take place on the holiday. So that negates your first counter argument.
I did not say it needed to. I said it does make it more impactful that it did.
Okay, final.
You know, on any holiday of you know, presenting someone alone on any holiday makes that aloneness more significant, or seemingly more significant. You know, obviously for their daily life of loneliness, it wouldn't change a thing, but.
Okay, so you've presented some good counterpoints, but I have perhaps the most damning piece of evidence against all of your arguments, Rob. And that is that Can't Buy Me Love appeared on the December 25th, 1992 USA Up All Night Christmas special episode. USA Up All Night, the very reason for why this podcast exists, and you and I are here today having this discussion. They dubbed this film a holiday movie, including it as the first film in their Christmas special where Rhonda Shear dressed up as a sexy Santa and went shopping. Rob, this is a holiday movie per USA Up All Night.
It can be the impetus for our podcast and still be wrong.
I'm going to tell Rhonda you said that. Oh, okay. Silent Night, Deadly Night 4 was the other Christmas pairing, by the way, on that holiday special that they had on Christmas night.
I will have to say too that, I mean, could it possibly simply be that you know, they're looking for viewers on a night, you know, that's tough to gain viewers, so you got to put some reasonably quality material in front of everyone, or a known entity, at least in this case. So maybe that's all they were going for. And then it happened to cover a holiday. So yeah,
sounds like you're making the argument for me now. I feel like you come around and now you're making the argument for why this is a holiday movie.
No, I 100% not.
All right. Well, we're gonna have to take it to a Twitter poll and let the viewers weigh in on this, or the listeners and viewers of the film weigh in on this, because I feel like we're going in circles. But you've heard my argument, you've heard Rob's argument, so please weigh in on the Twitter poll that we will post on our Twitter page at Still Up Podcast. All right, Rob, let's dig into the movie here. Can't Buy Me Love is a break, like you mentioned, from putting some quality out there. It's a break from the typical USA up all night film. I mean, it is a teen comedy, which certainly fits the bill, but this is a Touchstone Pictures film, which was actually the film distribution arm of Disney. So,
I was unaware of that.
So this film by far has the best production value of any film we've covered so far. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it,
yeah, and I think in across the board, sort of top to bottom, the sort of the most uniform quality throughout the movie, and the best acting, and at least from a consistency perspective of the the major players all the way down to the sort of non-role players, just sort of uniformly better.
Yeah, it looks like it has a big budget, but Rob, Can't Buy Me Love was made for just $1.8 million. You can believe that. It was actually produced as an indie film. It grossed $31 million worldwide, so a great return on Disney's investment. Not bad for a film that almost didn't get made. The original script was written by Michael Swerdlick, and it was titled Boy Rents Girl.
Yeah.
Not a great title there.
That's a tough one.
It was actually purchased by TriStar Pictures, and when Swerdlick first met with studio execs at TriStar, he said one of the execs told him she didn't know why they bought the script because it was almost like prostitution in how Cindy Mancini was treated. So TriStar actually dumped the project. The script was then purchased and produced by the much smaller Apollo Pictures as the indie film. That explains the small, less than $2 million budget. Once it was finished, Disney purchased the film for $6 million, and then it was distributed via Touchstone. And this was one of their first outside acquisitions in company history. So a little bit of history here for Can't Buy Me Love and Disney. And Disney reportedly spent $100,000 for the rights to the Beatles song Can't Buy Me Love. So in perspective, that ended up being more than 5% of the film's original budget.
Oh, I was going to say, I wasn't able to find anything about the budget, so I'd be curious. Mm-hmm. And you answered the question already.
Yeah, there you go. So Can't Buy Me Love debuted in theaters on August 14th, 1987. It grossed almost $5 million on its opening weekend, so Disney almost recouped its costs there right off the bat. It originally aired on USA Up All Night on June 30th, 1992 on a special USA Up All Night episode titled Grad Night 92. And the second film played that night was the John Hughes film 16 Candles. So Up All Night with a little gift to graduating viewers with some quality here on Grad Night. What do you think of that premise, Rob? And do you remember this?
I don't remember this. I don't remember seeing 16 Candles, in relation with this at all. So I think a good move, to garner viewers. Yeah, that's a smart decision.
Yeah, they were always looking for something happening in pop culture or, something relative to the themes of their movies, a.k.a. the Christmas special. And so this occurring around graduation time, and I don't remember seeing this either, and I certainly don't remember seeing this coupled with a John Hughes film, but obviously they went with a complete break from the traditional schlock that they have on that night anyway. As I mentioned earlier, it then played as a part of Rhonda's Christmas show on a USA Up All Night that was on Christmas night 1992. USA Up All Night would again air this on Christmas 1993. And then they, the evidence is mounting, Rob, against your argument here with two Christmas appearances for this film on Up All Night. It aired three more times between then and 1996. It is directed by Steve Rash, who is not a household name by any stretch of the means, but he did direct a few classics, including the 1993 Pauly Shore comedy Son-in-Law and the 1996 Whoopi Goldberg comedy Eddie.
Son-in-Law is a household favorite here. Mm-hmm. There are just a few scenes in that movie that I will forever find funny.
Yeah. Yeah. A cult classic in our household as well. In the early 2000s, he directed some straight-to-video sequels, including American Pie Bandcamp and two Bring It On sequels. And Rob, it might surprise you, it did me, that Rash's directorial debut actually came in 1978 with The Buddy Holly Story.
Oh, wow. So he's done some, that was a decent movie. Yeah. So yeah, he's got some acumen there.
Yeah, he made his jump to comedy in 1981 with the Hollywood satire film Under the Rainbow, starring Chevy Chase and Carrie Fisher. I mean, I want to dig more into the career of Steve Rash at some point, because it seems like he should be more well-known and have a bigger filmography, but he only had like 15 films to his credit and nothing recent.
Yeah, I saw that as well, and was kind of surprised with a few of the movies that he had on there that it was sort of a, you know, short career or not a lot happened.
Yeah. So Patrick Dempsey was cast as Ronald Miller because they wanted someone who wasn't well-known to play the nerdy lead role. And, you know, even then, one of the only big issues I have with the film is that I felt like it was a bit of a stretch to paint Dempsey, even a gangly 21-year-old Patrick Dempsey, as the school's number one nerd. Rob, what was your take on Dempsey as, you know, the nerd and his crew of nerd friends in the film?
I mean, there's certainly a kind of goofy quality to him, but, you know, it's like with all those movies where you put glasses on someone and make their hair disheveled and suddenly they're unattractive or, you know, or nerdy or, you know, whatever. You know, it's sort of a Hollywood trope because, you know, Hollywood's in the business of casting attractive people. So I think he was certainly surrounded by the right group to be a part of sort of the nerd crew. But yeah, as you said, he didn't really fit the bill all too well.
Yeah, I love the scene where, you know, the first day of school, walking in together with his now fake girlfriend, and she's like, okay, we got to do something about your appearance. He's, you know, just wearing a shirt tucked in and a beret on his head and literally the glasses. And she does, you know, takes the beret off, runs mousse through the hair, rips the sleeves of his shirt off, yeah, untucks it, and then takes the glasses off. And boom, there you go. Ronald Miller becomes Ronnie, the soon-to-be cool kid.
I always love that move in movies of just sort of lightly tug at the seam on a shoulder and mm-hmm. away rips the whole shoulder, you know, as though it's nothing.
Yeah, definitely in the 80s, clothing must have just been made incredibly cheap with their stitchings anyway. So an even lesser known Amanda Peterson was cast as Cindy Mancini, the captain of the cheerleaders, most popular girl in school, and as we've already discussed, a possible second protagonist of the film. Peterson was just 16 years old when the film was shot. And Rob, her story is very tragic. She would not enjoy the same success that her counterpart Patrick Dempsey did after this film. In fact, in 1994, she retired from acting altogether after a series of TV series appearances and made-for-TV movies. She struggled with drug abuse, and she was arrested 4 times between 2000 and 2012 for various reasons, including DUI and possession of narcotic equipment. She was found dead in her Colorado apartment in 2015. She was just 43 years old at the time of her death. And Rob, her series of mugshots are so sad. I mean, they look like the public service announcements for why you shouldn't do drugs. You know, watching her physical appearance just fade so quickly. It was sad to see her downfall, especially after playing just such a young, spirited role in this film.
Well, yeah, and she, you know, had a number of sort of bit parts in TV series and things like that. So, yeah, it seemingly had a bright future ahead of her. It's sad, you know, how things turned out.
Yeah, and, you know, because she wasn't as well known, there's not a whole lot documented as to why, except after her death, her mom came out and said she had struggled with drug abuse, but she had been clean. I believe she has two children, so it's just incredibly sad. And she, you know, she was great in this. I mean, I'm really surprised, yeah, being such a young, attractive actress that she didn't get some prime roles after this.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, you know, particularly when you know, in hindsight, like at the time watching it, I had no idea she was actually 16, you know, and of the age of her character. And yeah, it's you know, again, a sad tale.
Yeah, she seemed a bit of an old soul, as you know, you talked about her character arc, and she really does have an arc from this kind of just. She even admittedly says, you know, I do two good things, shop and lay around and do nothing at one point. Yeah. And yet she becomes this kind of more caring and understanding person. So a big character arc, and she as an actress, I thought was perfect for that role. So the movie was remade in 2003 by Warner Brothers, dubbed Love Don't Cost a Thing, and it starred Nick Cannon as the nerd in the Patrick Dempsey role. I didn't watch this version out of principle. Normally when a classic that I love is remade, I avoid it like the plague. I'll never watch the Footloose remake. I'll never watch this one either. Did you see Love Don't Cost a Thing, or do you remember when it was remade?
I had, in research for this, was my first time learning it was a remake of this. You know, is it really a remake when the same writer's involved?
Oh, one of the producers, yeah. I think that almost lends some validity to it if you've got somebody involved in the first one. But even then, you just don't mess with a classic. So,
well, it says the writer was involved as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't see that. I just saw one of the producers. Yeah. So, okay. Well, interesting. I still won't do it.
But yeah, I never saw it. Maybe at the time I would have, just for comparison purposes, to see what they had changed. But yeah, I'm back with you and not having seen it, so can't comment.
All right. So we've already talked quite a bit about the plot of the film. So let's just briefly break it down in chronological order. As I mentioned, this is a rags to riches sort of teen comedy where our nerd, Ronald Miller, is in love with his neighbor, Cindy Mancini. He's been mowing lawns all summer between his junior and senior year to save up for a telescope. So that's he's a smarty because he's willing to spend $1,000 on a telescope. Cindy Mancini is presented as somewhat of a sympathetic character, even though she's the most popular girl in school, because her boyfriend Bobby has gone off to play football at Iowa and has basically forgotten her. So we get a little bit of opening exposition to kind of make us feel sympathetic for this girl that otherwise seems to have it all. So a lovelorn Cindy asks to borrow her mom's white suede outfit for a back-to-school party, but her mom says no. Cindy wears it anyway, and wouldn't you know it, one of the school's jocks, Quint, spills red wine all over the outfit. And when Ronald goes to the mall to purchase the telescope that he's been saving up for, or microscope, as his mom constantly calls it in a running gag that I find hilarious, he views Cindy through the telescope across the mall, desperately trying to return the stained outfit. And he runs to the store, $1,000 in hand, which happens to be the exact cost of the outfit, and then makes a proposition to Cindy to pretend to date him for a month to make him popular.
I want to rent you.
You want to rent me?
Yeah. You pretend you like me, and we go out for just a few weeks, and that will make me popular.
Just going out with me is not going to make you popular.
Well, I have $1,000. It says it will.
Rob, I thought the exposition just breezed right along here, introducing all the key elements leading up to the deal that Cindy and Ronald would broker. What did you think of the film's opening act?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. They, jumped to it very quickly to really, lend time for the character arcs, which I think was a smart idea.
Yeah, and then a lot happens in the next month, told through a series of scenes that, to me, just like Act One, just kind of breeze by naturally. Ronald slowly gets accepted by the popular clique, and he starts to become more comfortable in his skin as a cool kid. He quickly alienates his old friends, standing them up for poker nights and football games without telling them. It's done implicitly, but we start to see this, Ronald slowly turning into a bit of a jerk at times. But unless you were in the small group of super popular cheerleaders or jocks in your high school, you likely sympathized and related more to Ronald's want to climb the social ladder. What'd you make of the evolution here of Ronald Miller during his month of dating Cindy Mancini?
Well, it definitely goes to his head at a point in a crescendo when he has his sort of argument with Cindy and about her riding the Ronnie train and it not costing him $1,000. We sort of reach peak asshole at that point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's what he ends up doing to his friends and his rise is pretty pretty sad, and but there's, I think, something there for everyone, because we all, as we get older, sort of go from one group of friends to another, and not all of it is in, like in this case, an intentional thing. Some of it just sort of happens, and there are shades of that sort of shown in here when they typically refer back to, you know, oh, we went to, you know, we were in sixth grade together, or we, you know, I don't remember how early back they first, what that first mention is, whether it was like kindergarten together, and you know, how they all go their separate ways. And Kenneth, you know, his best friend, talks about, you know, sort of liking who they are and not having a problem with not being a part of the cool clique.
Yeah, the scripting I thought was really clever in just the way it kind of slid information into us that gave us a theme throughout the film, but it wasn't hitting us over the head with it, except in those moments where the characters were delivering their important monologues. Yeah, there's a scene when Kenneth Worman, his best friend, who's played by Courtney Gaines, in my opinion, underrated character actor, who would later appear with Patrick Dempsey in Sweet Home Alabama. So it was cool to see their reunion on screen. But yeah, he says, you know, they're just discussing Ronald's musings on being popular in their final year, and Kenneth, you know, says, "I like who we are," and you know, "we were all forced to be in the same room." It was their line of why they used to all be friends and now they're not, now that they've moved on to high school. So a really good kind of just clever way to introduce that, of, you know, you got two characters here traversing down different roads, where Ronald Miller wants to be popular and Kenneth is enjoying his status and accepting where he is in the social rung of high school. I thought Dempsey and Peterson had great chemistry, and I loved how their relationship progressed from those early awkward stages. You know, like Ronald picks up Cindy for a date without a car. And then by the end of their time that the month is up, you see Ronald driving Cindy's car. So that was just kind of a neat little clever way. It's not, again, not hit us over the head with it, but just we see it on screen. And you, that's, you know, that's something when you start trusting your boyfriend to drive your car. And we need to talk about Cindy's car, right? We've seen and talked about yes, this before. Yes. It's a staple for beautiful women in 80s movies. It's the white convertible Volkswagen. Rob, we saw this in Fraternity Vacation, right? And in that episode, we discussed its appearance in License to Drive, and now we see it here as Cindy Mancini's car.
Here it is again. Yes.
Yeah.
Apparently, either that's the same car being passed around by movie studios, or, you know, that was a quintessential, you know, popular pretty girl car. Yeah, in my neck of the woods, it certainly, I don't think I ever saw one. So,
yeah, certainly not me either. But I went to high school in the Midwest, so that wasn't exactly a meant for the Midwest car.
Yeah,
trying to drive
yeah.
that in the winter. This was set in Tucson, Arizona, which you and I had previously discussed. Just kind of an odd place for it to be, but then if you see the indie kind of spirit of this film, and it was actually shot, a lot of the scenes were shot in the Tucson High School with students and teachers as extras. So, you know, finding out that it was done on pretty basically a shoestring budget, you know, kind of explains some of the reasons for why it took place. And it's just such an odd, you know, we both agreed this feels like it would be made in LA, you know, like a Hollywood
sort
school.
Of- what you assume going in, you know, but then as you know, you see a little bit more of the landscape, it's clearly not. And yeah, you know, I didn't see anything in investigating if there was some sort of tax break afforded to filming in Arizona, or if yeah, it just was, you know, like you said, because of the school worked with them, if they just ended up there. Or...
Yeah, I didn't either. I actually didn't uncover any kind of roadmap to how they ended up in Tucson. And again, it's also, it didn't play a major role in any way in the narrative. It's just the only way we see it is, you know, when you see it on there, like I saw their baseball uniforms had Tucson across the front. And then at one point in the school, you see it referenced in like a sign about the sports team. So that's really the only couple times that it comes up. So it doesn't play any role narratively. Okay, so Ronald takes Cindy to an airplane graveyard to view the moon through a telescope in a super romantic final date as their month comes to an end. And it turns into what I thought was a tragic scene. You know, the two are just not on the same page here. Cindy's fallen for Ronald, and you know, she wants to continue this relationship. Ronald, he couldn't even grasp that she would be into him. So in the scene, Ronald says he's new to all of this and asks Cindy how they should do it. She tells him that they should just let it happen naturally. She's talking about a kiss. She wants to kiss him. He's talking about how to stage their breakup. Were you as broken up about this as I was, Rob? By this point in the movie, I loved these two as a couple, and I didn't want them to break up.
Yeah, and I think the movie did a good job, and I think it was more for just them of almost all the characters, giving them a moment of sort of more humanity than they would typically get as these archetypes, you know, the super popular kids or the jocks, or they all had one little line somewhere in there where they showed an extra level of sympathy and that they were, you know, like normal people. And that, yeah, at times or at one point we were all friends and sort of helped connect that. And so, yeah, she obviously gets more of those moments than anyone else, and that went a long way into building. You could see she was a good human being, and they really hit it off, and he introduced all sorts of new things to her, and yeah, and here you are. And I thought the scene played really well, just the whole flow of it, where, you know, she's, as you said, talking about, you know, their first kiss and how it transitions, and because he can't, again, as you said, conceive that she would ever really be into him, so he goes right into the, you know, how to do our breakup, and, mm-hmm. and is just blind and oblivious to the fact that that's not at all what she's talking about.
Let's talk a minute about this small but popular group of friends that they have. That, you know, Cindy surrounds herself with her two besties, Barbara and Patty. Barbara as Tina Caspary, who starred in My Mom's a Werewolf, as featured in episode 2 of Still Up All Night. And then opposite of the gals here is the three boys, Big John, Quint, and Ricky. Ricky's played by 90s one-hit wonder pop star Gerardo. I love that.
Yeah, Rico Suave
yes.
himself.
And then Big John is played by Eric Bruscotter, who has a huge filmography that includes Starship Troopers, Crimson Tide, and a ton of TV series appearances. I love this group. Each one had a unique personality, and as you said, they, you know, everybody was given a chance to kind of breathe a little bit. They weren't just mindless drones that you might normally find in a teen comedy, even though they obviously take part in the group mentality of the popular clique. That was one of the themes. But, you know, Big John was, you know, just kind of the big dumb jock, but, you know, unassuming. And Quint was the real jerk of the group. I mean, just completely careless. And he's the one that spills wine on the Cindy's outfit, but then, you know, doesn't even think twice about it, doesn't apologize. And then Ricky, played by Gerardo, is the just, you know, the real, he's the Rico Suave, right? He's the player. Yeah. He's always seen with the ladies. What'd you think of the small group of popular kids here?
I mean, they checked all the boxes, covered all the bases, you know. But I, as I sort of indicated before, I think they were all given a little bit more than they normally would. Like, I feel like so many scenes could have easily been played of them just being horribly ruthless and insulting it, you know, every turn. And they aren't. They have moments where they, you know, and you see it as they fairly quickly come to accept Ronnie and enjoy spending some time with him. I think the casting was well done and it worked in this case.
Yeah. So, after their staged breakup, Cindy tells Ronald to never change. And Ronald says, "Oh, me never." And then the film cuts to the next scene of Ronald bursting through the doors, hair slicked back with tons of product, sunglasses on inside the school, just acting ridiculous because now he's popular and he'll get away with it. And, you know, we've created a monster here. And like you said, just, you know, the douchebaggery it starts to become off the charts here once he's released from dating Cindy, faux dating Cindy.
I think that's one of the only times you get sort of a hint that you're in Arizona too, because his outfit is sort of Western inspired.
Yeah.
You know, he has I always forget what those things are called, but it's like the bolo mm-hmm. necktie thing, and yep. it kind of has like a you know, some stones in it that, you know, are sort of a regional thing for Arizona.
Yeah. So Patty tells Ronald he's taking her to the Columbus Day dance, and Ronald tells her he has moves that are out of this world. The problem is he can't dance. So he turns on what he thinks is American Bandstand, but it turns out to be the PBS African Cultural Hour, and the dance move Ronald copied were from the African Anteater Ritual. And when he starts to do this dance at the school, everybody starts to join in, much to the chagrin of Cindy, who starts to realize how, you know, the dynamics of school cliques and popularity is working by just watching the entire school mindlessly follow Ronald. And this dance was actually choreographed by Paula Abdul, which learning this doesn't make me feel as bad for having done this dance myself at a high school dance or two. What did you think of the African Anteater Ritual?
I mean, that's just one of the best scenes in the movie, as you know, we sort of already touched on outside of the podcast, where you then see, you know, his parents doing the dance at their holiday party. So, yeah, it just, you know, obviously ridiculous, but, you know, it went a long way to showing, you know, how these cliques and, you know, the mindset of everyone. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a great scene. And of course, we also, that's where we're one of the better scenes for a young Seth Green comes in, where he's the one to realize that his brother, you know, was watching the wrong channel, and, you know, finds that absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, Seth Green as the younger brother here that knows something's up, just because he knows how weird his brother is and that Cindy Mancini would never date him. And so it's just kind of another running gag where nothing ever really comes of it, but he's constantly, you know, following his brother, jumping in the back of the car to try to find on dates to find out what's going on. And he is just, his character is hilarious in this film. And the dance scene too, once everybody starts doing it, you've got his former nerdy friends who are
that's right.
Referred to as the nerd herd by the cool kids, sitting on the sides of the dance, and they all recognize it and all point it out and at the same time say, it's the African Anteater Ritual. I love that scene. Hilarious. Okay, so Ronnie is firmly entrenched in the cool clique, and a pivotal moment of the film occurs on Halloween night when Quint, Big John, and Ricky pull their annual prank by throwing eggs and tomatoes and dog shit on a house. And it turns out their annual house that they hit is the house of Kenneth, Ronnie's former best friend, and who he's long now alienated. And I would argue that this is the midpoint for Ronald's character, because it's kind of the final step that he has to take to just fully commit to shedding his own persona and becoming a popular kid willing to do whatever it takes to keep his social status. And when he objects to doing it, Ricky says to Big John, "See, I told you he was still a nerd." And that was enough to push Ronald over the top and grab the bag, toss it at Kenneth's door. But Kenneth's family was waiting. They were prepared this year to catch these hooligans in the act. And Ronnie gets caught up in a net running away, and Kenneth realizes it's Ronnie and lets him go. This was Ronald's full turn to the dark side. Would you agree?
100%, yeah, you know, and made all the more impactful the next day at school when, you know, Kenneth confronts him and you know, we get the seminal line, "You shit on my house."
Yes, that was almost removed from the film, but Steve Rash argued that it was powerful enough that needed to stay in, because this is ultimately, you know, it was Disney that purchased the rights to the film, and so I'm glad that stayed in. So this all culminates on New Year's Eve with the party that we've previously discussed that makes it a holiday film. Cindy's drunk and overhears Ronald using some lines from a poem that she wrote and shared with him earlier to seduce another girl, and that, coupled with Bobby showing up at the party and confronting her for supposedly dating the lawn boy, leads Cindy to confess in front of everyone at the party the truth about Ronald paying her $1,000 to go out with her Ronald becomes a social pariah, and for the next several months, he's basically exiled by everyone at school. You know, he tries to make things right with Kenneth at the arcade after this, but this is when, like you just mentioned, Kenneth grabs him and, you know, yells at him while teary-eyed, "You shit on my house, man! You shit on my house!" Real powerful scene between the two. Sometime later, we see Kenneth helping Patty with her homework at lunch, to which Quint accuses him of pulling a Ronald McDonald Miller scam and trying to worm his way into the cool clique. And he yanks Kenneth from the seat and pushes Patty down, which was a bit of a surprising move. I'm surprised that was left in there. But it really drove home what a jerk, you know, Quint was of this group. Ronald's watching all this from afar, and he finally decides to do something about it. He runs over, he picks up a bat on the way, and he delivers an awesome monologue about how ridiculous high school cliques are.
Oh, return of the living bread.
Why don't you lay off?
Why don't you go back where you belong, Jose?
Take your hands off Kenneth, or I'll break your arm. Your pitching arm.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, don't make me laugh,
blonde boy.
Let go.
No! You broke your arm once before, remember? You fell out of our treehouse. Kenneth picked you up, and we carried you 12 blocks to the hospital.
Yeah, you cried all the way.
We were all friends then, remember? And now you want to end his life because he's talking to Patty on your side of the cafeteria. Oh, man, it's stupid. I know, because that's where I wanted to be. On your side, with your crowd. But I messed up. See, I tried to buy my way in. But Kenneth, he's not trying to buy anybody. He's just trying to make friends. Being himself. Cools, nerds, your side, my side. Man, it's all bullshit. It's just tough enough to be yourself.
What'd you think of the film's climax here, Rob?
Oh, this is, a scene, and we touched on this outside of here, but yeah, you know, it's, you can recite it verbatim. I probably almost can, and it's a scene that has always just stuck with me, you know, because as I indicated earlier, we all have, you know, that sort of time in our life as we get older and you watch, you know, friends slowly travel in different directions as you know, we're no longer forced to be in the same classroom and you lose touch with people that you thought, you know, would be friends for life or were, you know, your best friend, and next thing you know, you're in high school and you're all in wildly different groups. So yeah, that moment, you know, that whole scene of you know, we carried you 12 blocks to the hospital with a broken arm and you cried the whole way. Yeah, I love that scene.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for sentimental moments, and I tear up every single time I watch this, even though I know it's coming, and yeah, like you said, I can recite it word for word. So the falling action, Act 3 of the film, it's pretty long, which I liked, especially for 80s films that kind of wrap up really quickly. Ronald still has to make things right with Cindy, and they finally do talk and smooth things over. The film ends like it began, with Ronald back on the mower. Cindy comes out with a check from her mom to pay Ronald for the lawn work. She gets into her car, or gets into a car with friends, but then tire screech. Cindy jumps out of the car, runs back to Ronald, jumps on the mower. Cue the Beatles song "Can't Buy Me Love," and our couple is finally officially together. What'd you think of the ending?
Well, the one thing that stuck out to me is a little bit odd is, when the car pulls up, the guys in it, we have not seen the entire movie. It's the same crew of girls.
Yeah, Patty and Barbara in the back.
Patty and Barb, yeah. And then two just sort of random guys brought in. I just always thought, you know, you expect it to be, you know, Big John and Ricky or you know, somebody from school, and it isn't. Anyway, a fitting finale to the movie. As she hops on the mower and they have their first kiss. So,
yeah, good stuff. So, you know, this is, I don't even think this is a question we need to ask, but we always ask it. Rob, is Can't Buy Me Love worth staying up all night for?
100%. Yeah. you know, a great, you know, teen comedy that has a little something in it, I think, that everybody can connect with. And despite what many of the critics have said about it, I know more people that enjoy this movie than don't.
Yeah, it's funny because every time I watch this movie, I forget how much I absolutely love it. I wore this film out on VHS as a kid. I can recite it nearly line for line. It's fun, it's cheesy, but it says a lot for a teen comedy about high school life, the desire to become popular, but also the importance of being yourself. You know, it feels so much like a John Hughes film, which is major props to Steve Rash and the entire Apollo Productions team, who did just a heck of a job with less than $2 million and an inexperienced cast. It's not only worth staying up for, but it should be in your own movie collection along with all the John Hughes classics, in my opinion. So, you know, this one might not be as fun, Rob, because of the quality of the movie, but let's check in with what others are saying about the film. What do you think the audience score out of 100 is on Rotten Tomatoes for Can't Buy Me Love?
And I have to, I didn't intentionally cheat, but I think I saw it and I believe it was 48%, and I was blown away by that.
Well, you have it reversed. So it has a 74% approval rating, and that's with 48,244 votes, so nearly 50,000 votes from just your general film goer on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's a fresh. Close to it. It's got a little popcorn next to it. I don't know if it's fresh rating gives you the full tomato. I'm not sure if that's like above 80 or how that works. But surprisingly, the critics are, as you mentioned, the critics score for the film is just 48%. It only has 23 critics ratings. That's criminal, if you ask me. You know, even if the narrative is not for you, the film is much better than a 48% fresh score. I wanted to know why. So here are some of the negative comments from critics. One critic wrote, "Its conformist happy ending negates the initial nonconformist feeling of the original premise." And I don't think the critic put a whole lot of time into trying to deconstruct the narrative and maybe didn't even stick around for that final monologue, which was the whole point of the film. Another critic wrote, "Standard 80s teen angst fodder." So this critic, I don't think, understands why we love 80s teen movies so much. Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's because of the angst and how we deal with it. So I'm not sure if you remove the teen angst from 80s movies, I don't know what you have left. And then another critic wrote, "The film thinks it wants to be sincere when all it truly wants to be is popular, just like the other kids' movies. So it sells off its originality." I think that this critique is unoriginal. In trying to compare the narrative to your own critique. So I don't agree with that as well. I don't know. What do you think of those critics' comments?
Well, I don't know if you saw, Ebert gave it half a star. He hated this movie.
Wow.
He felt that it essentially like presented a lot but had almost nothing to say about what it presents relative to, say, a John Hughes movie.
Wow, so, that's insane.
It was like a pale imitation in his eyes.
Oh.
Which is where I was like, what?
Yeah,
I mean, I could see him not liking it, but half a star was, not at all what I expected.
Yeah, and you know, we pointed out just the many ways that the theme and the messages were carried out quite cleverly in this film. So I'm amazed of Ebert. I mean, I don't know these other critics from Rotten Tomatoes, so I can't really take umbrage with what they like and don't like. But that really surprised me, disappoints me, coming from Ebert. So
very much so.
All right, so I know the answer, but before we close, I have to ask you, Rob, have I changed your mind at all? Will you now call Can't Buy Me Love a holiday movie?
Absolutely not.
Oh, that strong, huh?
Yes.
Oh.
But, I mean, you've already, I mean, when the sort of origin of this entire argument comes from Die Hard, and I'm firmly in the camp that it is not, so it's going to take a heck of a lot more information and swaying for me to change my mind about this movie.
Okay. Well, we want you to weigh in. Please take our poll on Twitter and let us know if you think Can't Buy Me Love is a holiday movie. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Still Up Podcast. unlike Ronald Miller, we promise to never change, so join us next month where we will return to our B-movie roots and break down another schlocky USA up all night, classically bad movie.
Can't wait.
So have you saved up enough money?
Yeah.
$1,500. Yeah, I mowed 331 miles of grass this summer. That's $4.54 per mile.
Mm, the Ronald Miller story. My life on a mower.
How much is the microscope?